Long ago, a man named Job wrote these words that we find in Job chapter 9 and verses 1 through 12. This is what Job says. I know it is so of a truth, but how should man be just with God? If you will contend with him, he cannot answer him one of a thousand. He is wise in heart and mighty in strength, who hath hardened himself against him and hath prospered, which removeth the mountains and they know not, which overturneth them in his anger, which shaketh the earth out of her place and the pillars thereof tremble, which commandeth the sun and it riseth not, and sealeth up the stars, which alone spreadeth out the heavens and treadeth upon the waves of the sea, which maketh Arcturus, Orion, and the Pleiades, and the chambers of the south, which doeth great things past finding out, yea, and wonders without number. Lo, he goeth by me, and I see him not. He passeth on also, and I perceive him not. Behold, he taketh away, and who can hinder him? Who will say unto him, what doest thou? Job, even before he came to a full realization of how small he was and how big God is, even in chapter 9 of the book of Job, Job was telling forth the greatness of his God. And he closed in verse 12 of our passage, behold, he takes away, and who can hinder him? Who will say unto him, what doest thou? Who of us can ask God, what are you doing? None of us are in that position, right? You know, we may ask God that question, either in our minds or by our words, audibly spoken, but none of us really are in the position to ask God what he's doing. Why? Because God knows what he's doing, right? Would you agree with me this morning? God knows what he's doing. The God that Job served is the same God that we serve. The God of Job's day was an all-powerful, a sovereign, a wise God. And you know what? God has not changed, because the God that we serve today is all-powerful. He's sovereign. He's in control. He's all-wise. God is a God who does things beyond our comprehension. Job recognized that. I hope that we recognize that today as well. Our God is a God who performs innumerable wonders, and Job named some of them off. And we could go to the book of Psalms and we could read about many of the wonders that the psalmist speaks of. We ourselves can recount the wonders of our God. And as we consider God's wonders, we should stand in amazement and awe of him. What God has determined to do, he is in fact going to do it. There's no man or woman, there's no angel, there's no force of nature that can hinder his hand. There's no one, absolutely no one, that's in a position to rightfully ask God, what are you doing? What are you up to? You know, we may wonder, but who are we to question what God is doing, either in our lives or in the lives of those that we love or in the world around us? No one's in that position to question God. What Job said of God so many years ago is just as true today as it was thousands of years ago. Our God is powerful and sovereign and wise, and he does amazing things, and his will is going to be fulfilled in ways that astound us many times. Along with Paul, we can exclaim these words that he writes in Romans chapter 11, verses 33 through 36. Paul says this, oh, the depth of the riches both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. For who hath known the mind of the Lord, or who hath been his counselor, or who hath first given to him, and it shall be recompensed unto him again? For of him, and through him, and to him are all things, to whom be glory forever. Amen. Right along with Paul, we can say of God, we can praise him. You are all wise. The depths of your wisdom, we can't even fathom. The depths of your knowledge are beyond compare. We can't even understand how wise you are, how knowledgeable you are, how all-knowing you are. God is a good God. He's an all-powerful God. He's all-wise and he's in control. And as you think about the very beginning, whenever God said, let there be light, and there was light, and eventually he created Adam, and then Eve was created through one of Adam's ribs. But from that very beginning, right, God knew what he was doing, and he had a perfect plan. And from that very beginning, his will has been accomplished day after day, year after year, century after century. And many times God chooses to work in what we'd call quote-unquote normal ways to fulfill his will. Other times he works supernaturally, where he goes above and beyond or even overriding what's regular and established in this world. But either way, God's hand is at work. He is fulfilling his will by both the quote-unquote normal and the quote-unquote abnormal or supernatural. And even whenever God fulfills his will in a normal way, there are many times where we're just astounded. We look back and see how God has worked, and we're amazed at how God brought these things to pass, how God did his will in our life. God keeps his promises. Aren't you thankful that God keeps his promises? And many times he fulfills his promises, he keeps those promises in ways that just totally blow us away. They amaze us, they astound us. We can never have foreseen or imagined how God would do his perfect will in our life, how he would keep his promises. I want us to focus in on a promise this morning. It's found in Acts chapter 23 and verse 11. But before we go to that passage and as we consider the passage and look at the promise, I want us to think about the context, and we've been preaching through the chapters all the way up until 25 so far. I've been preaching, rather, and we find Paul in the recent context here. He's accused of wrongdoing. He's accused by certain of the Jews of doing wrong. The Jews accused him of teaching against the nation Israel and against the law and against the temple. And they accused Paul of bringing a Gentile into the temple and thus profaning the temple. And the Jews had violently reacted against Paul. And they had taken him and they were beating him. And they were going to beat him to death, no doubt. But as they were in the process of beating Paul, what happened? A Roman tribune came along with many soldiers and Paul was delivered. And the uprising was put down in a peaceful manner. And Paul there shortly after was allowed to preach or speak to the huge group or crowd of people, but yet they really wouldn't listen. Later on, he was brought before the Sanhedrin, and he explained himself to a certain extent there, but still no positive judgment on his behalf. And it seemed as if Paul was in a bad position. It seems as if he was going to meet an untimely demise in the city of Jerusalem here. His own people, the Jews, were against him. They wanted to kill him. The Romans were keeping him in custody, and who knows when he would be released. And it's in this context that we read this promise in Acts chapter 23 and verse 11. It's the night after he had been before the Sanhedrin. And we read this: "The night following, the Lord stood by him and said, 'Be of good cheer, Paul, for as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, rather, so thou must also bear witness also at Rome.'" That's the Lord's promise to Paul. "Just as you've testified of me in Jerusalem, so also you will testify of me in Rome." Well, immediately after that promise, what happened? There was a murderous plot that was uncovered against Paul. There are certain of the Jews that wanted to kill him. They said, "We aren't even going to eat or drink until Paul is dead." Well, word had got to the tribune, and the tribune sent Paul under armed escort to the city of Caesarea. And there in Caesarea, he stood before the governor Felix. And the Jews came down and they accused him of many things that he had done wrong. And Paul himself defended himself against the accusations. And it was evident that Paul was innocent. At least for us, looking at the situation, it's evident he's innocent. But Felix, the governor, refused to take action. He kept him under Roman guard for 2 years, until the time he was removed from office and another man stepped into office. That other man was named Festus. And it's in this context that we come to the fulfillment of God's promise, or at least the way his promise is going to be fulfilled. Remember, what was God's promise to Paul? "Just as you've been a witness for me in Jerusalem, so also you will be a witness for me in Rome." Well, how is Paul possibly going to get to Rome? Here he is. He's stuck in Caesarea. He's been stuck in Caesarea for 2 years. It seems like things are in limbo. And the Jews are against him, and the Romans don't want to take any decisive action. How is he going to get to Rome? But yet the Lord promised, "You're going to be a witness for me in Rome." So it's in this context that we read what happens in Paul's life. We might wonder, well, how's everything going to work out? Paul himself is probably wondering, how is God going to keep his promise? Well, Paul, as things were accomplished, no doubt he was standing in awe of God's great hand at work. He realized God is at work in mysterious ways. And we today, even though we're not in Paul's place, even though we're not in jail in Caesarea and we won't be taken to Rome, we can still stand back and be in awe at God's wonderful plan, his perfect plan. He's going to work in mysterious ways in our lives as well. He's going to masterfully bring things together to fulfill his will for our lives. This morning we want to focus in on the mysterious ways of our God in Acts chapter 25, verses 1 through 12. If you're using one of our pew Bibles, it's page 1287. And as we read through this passage, we'll see God's hand at work in Paul's life. God is working in mysterious ways to accomplish his perfect will. So as we read through the passage, we'll see, first of all, how the Jews attempt to implement a murderous plot by asking Festus, the new governor, to bring Paul to Jerusalem, but the plan was for the Jews to kill him on the way. Well, as we come to verses 4 through 5, Festus, the governor, denies the request. He foils their plot. He instructs the Jews to come to Caesarea, and Paul can be tried there. In verses 6 through 8, we have Festus and the Jewish leaders. They travel to Caesarea. Paul is accused by the Jews, and then Paul defends himself. Well, in verse 9, we find Festus. He gives the Jews a favor, and he asks Paul, will you go to Jerusalem and there be tried of me before the Jews? And then verses 10 through 12, Paul strongly desists. He appeals to Caesar, and that appeal is granted by Festus. And in appealing to Caesar, he's going to be on his way to Rome. So who would have thought that chain of events would lead to Paul's going to Rome? You know, Paul probably in his mind at one point in time, we know that he had a plan to go to Rome, and even beyond there, to Spain. He had a plan figured out in his mind of what he wanted to do. Of course, it was all subject to the Lord's perfect will. Who would have thought that Paul would have gone to Rome in this way? You know, Paul couldn't have told anybody that this is how it would be fulfilled. He knew the Lord promised, you'll go to Rome and be a witness for me, but he didn't know how that would come to pass. So let's look at chapter 25 of Acts, verses 1 through 12. First of all, verses 1 through 3, we'll see how the Jews attempted, they had a plan to kill Paul, how they attempted to implement that plan. Look at verses 1 through 3. Now when Festus was come into the province, after 3 days he ascended from Caesarea to Jerusalem, then the high priest and the chiefs of the Jews informed him against Paul and besought him, and desired favor against him, that he would send for him to Jerusalem, laying wait in the way to kill him. So Felix at this point in time was no longer governor over the region of Judea. Instead, there was a man named Festus. Festus had just entered into office, and as a good leader, he wanted to go and talk with some of the influential men of the region. And so what does he do? He goes to Jerusalem. It's only after 3 days since he had been in office that he goes to Jerusalem. The seat of government is Caesarea. He goes from Caesarea to Jerusalem. He wants to talk to the influential men of Jerusalem, the Jewish leaders, because the Jewish leaders would really play an influential role, whether he would have a success as a governor or whether he would fail as a governor. Now, these Jewish leaders, many of them members of the Sanhedrin, or perhaps all of them, they were very eager to talk with Festus as well. The high priest, the other leaders of the Jewish people, took this opportunity of Festus' visit to bring their accusations to him, their grievances to him against Paul. And this point, as we look at this at this point in time, the high priest is no longer Ananias, as we read about earlier in Acts. Now Ananias has been replaced by a man named Ishmael. This man Ishmael was appointed by Herod Agrippa II. So you think about 2 years Paul had been sitting under Roman custody in Caesarea. A number of things would have changed. The high priest had changed. But one thing that had not changed was the Jews' hatred for Paul. In the Jews' mind, and they couldn't dismiss this lightly, in the Jews' mind, Paul had forsaken their religion. Paul had forsaken the way of the fathers. Paul was preaching heresy. He had apostatized as he preached salvation by grace through faith to both Gentiles and Jews through Jesus Christ. And so these Jewish leaders brought before Festus their grievances, and they desired a special favor from him. They said, Festus, why don't you bring Paul to Jerusalem so he can be tried in Jerusalem? Only their plan was not just to have him arrive safely in Jerusalem so he could be tried. Their plan was what? That Paul would never make it safely to Jerusalem. He'd be killed, ambushed on the way. Now, Festus, at this point in time, we don't know if he had any inkling of what the Jews were thinking or not. But we do know that he denied the request. Maybe he just didn't want to be kind of bullied around by these Jewish leaders, you know. And he wasn't bullied in that sense. But he didn't want to give in to the request. Maybe he was just very practical. Paul, at this point in time, was under Roman custody in Caesarea. Very soon, Festus himself would be returning to Caesarea. So why not just try him in Caesarea? So Festus says, no, I'm not going to transfer him to Jerusalem. You come up with me to Caesarea, and if you have any grievances, if he's done anything wrong, you can air those grievances. You can accuse him there before me in Caesarea. So that's what we read in verses 4 and 5. But Festus answered that Paul should not, or that Paul should be kept at Caesarea, and that he himself would depart shortly thither. Let them, therefore, said he, which among you are able, go down with me and accuse this man, if there be any wickedness in him. So here is Festus. He probably didn't think of anything as far as anything amiss being. What had the Jews done? The Jews had requested that Paul be transferred from Caesarea to Jerusalem. I don't think Festus thought there was anything amiss. I think he was just being practical and saying, come to Caesarea and I'll try him there. Those who have anything against him should travel with him. So nothing unusual so far, right? We have the same hatred of the Jews for Paul. We have the foiling of their plot by Festus denying the request. Now the new governor, Festus, is going to be hearing the accusations against Paul. He'll hear Paul's defense of himself in verses 6 through 8. So look at verse 6 there. And when he had tarried among them more than 10 days, he went down to Caesarea, and the next day, sitting on the judgment seat, commanded Paul to be brought. And when he was come, the Jews which came down from Jerusalem stood round about and laid many and grievous complaints against Paul, which they could not prove. While he answered for himself, neither against the law of the Jews, neither against the temple, nor yet against Caesar, have I offended anything at all. So here is Festus, the new governor. He remained in Jerusalem for a little over a week. And then he went back to the provincial capital of Caesarea. The next day, he sat on the judicial bench, and the trial of Paul began. Festus would hear the case for and against Paul. Now, many of the Jewish leaders had responded to Festus' instructions, come up to Caesarea, and he'll be tried there. So we have many Jews, many of the leaders, surrounding Paul, no doubt, and they bring grievous accusations against him. And this word grievous has the idea they're heavy, they're serious in nature. So these are not just what we'd consider misdemeanors. These are serious offenses. These could even be capital offenses against Paul. You know, the accusations leveled against him. And they're not just one or two. There are many, accusation after accusation after accusation brought against Paul. Now, the Jews wouldn't admit it, but Luke tells us plainly that their accusations, all of them, were without foundation. None of them could be proved. Try as hard as they might, they had no real case against Paul. So who knows how much time passed as the Jews accused Paul of wrongdoing before Festus. But then Paul had the opportunity to defend himself. No doubt he did it in a similar way as he had done before Felix 2 years ago. And sometimes, I don't know if I confused the two names earlier, but Felix is the one who's out of the picture now, and we have Festus now, the one who's trying Paul now. So Festus gave Paul the opportunity to defend himself. And Paul says, I haven't done anything against the law of the Jews. I haven't violated it in any way as I was there in Jerusalem. Paul says, I haven't done anything against the temple. I haven't attempted to defile it. Paul would have been totally opposed to defiling the temple. He wanted to keep it holy. He says, I haven't done anything against Caesar. I haven't fomented rebellion. I haven't stirred up trouble. I've been rather a proclaimer of peace. I'm in support of the government. I'm not against it. There are others to blame for the uprisings and the tumults and all of these things, the chaos. So far, as we look at what's going on here with Paul and the Jews and Festus, it seems like it's just a replay of what happened 2 years ago. What happened 2 years ago? Felix was there, the governor. The Jews accused him through Tertullus. And then they said, yeah, this is the case. Paul has done all these things wrong. Paul countered each accusation one by one and showed that he was innocent. And then what did Felix do? He did nothing. He just let it sit in limbo. Well, it seems like the same thing is going to happen. The Jews accusing Paul, Paul defending himself. What's Festus going to do now? Surely he's going to see that Paul is innocent. But is he going to take action? Well, we see that now things are going to change, and not for the better for Paul, at least from a human standpoint. Look at verse 9. But Festus, willing to do the Jews a pleasure, answered Paul and said, "Wilt thou go up to Jerusalem and there be judged of these things before me?" So up to this point, Festus had been unwilling to give any ground to the Jews, unwilling to give them any favors at all. But now Festus asks Paul, "Are you willing to go to Jerusalem and there be tried of me? Are you willing to go there?" So something has changed here. Festus is willing to work with the Jews. He's willing to give them a favor. And that's what it says in verse 9. But Festus, willing to do the Jews a pleasure, asked him, "Are you willing to go to Jerusalem and there be judged?" Now, no doubt Festus didn't realize what the Jews were planning all along. I think Festus was ignorant of the fact that they were planning to ambush and kill Paul. I think Festus maybe was just trying to get to the bottom of things. He realized that all of the trouble centered in Jerusalem. That's where it all began. And so, doesn't it make sense to try Paul in Jerusalem? Maybe some answers will be unearthed there. Maybe whenever the whole Sanhedrin is able to question him, maybe things will be different. Maybe Festus didn't realize what was going to happen, perhaps, if he was transferred to Jerusalem. And even if he arrived there safely, didn't Festus realize that there would be a lot more pressure on him to judge against Paul rather than for Paul, as the whole Sanhedrin was putting their pressure on him? But it was clear in Paul's mind that things had changed. Festus was no longer an impartial judge. He wasn't to be trusted with Paul's best interest. And maybe Festus was trying to be impartial, but we do know that he gave the Jews a pleasure. He gave them a favor. So it seems as if he's being biased right now. So what happens? Well, all of this is leading up to the Lord's fulfillment of his promise to Paul. Look at verses 10 through 12. Then said Paul, "I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, where I ought to be judged. To the Jews have I done no wrong, as though thou very well knowest. For if I be an offender or have committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. But if there be none of these things whereof these accuse me, no man may deliver me unto them. I appeal unto Caesar." Then Festus, when he had conferred with the council, answered, "Hast thou appealed unto Caesar? Unto Caesar shalt thou go." So Paul here, he is standing before Festus, the Roman governor. He was being tried before the judgment seat, the judicial bench, the bema of Caesar himself. Festus had Caesar's own authority to judge. So this is, Paul says, this is where it's necessary for me to be judged. Have I done anything against Rome or have I not? Paul already has made it clear he hasn't done anything against the Jews, and so there's no reason for him to go to Jerusalem to be tried at the seat of the Jews' government. There's no reason to be tried there at the seat of their religious life. Paul wasn't looking to escape his just due. He confesses, "If I've broken the law, I'm willing to face the punishment. I'm willing to pay the consequences. If I've committed a capital offense, I'm willing to die. But if he's innocent," Paul says, "I'm not going to be turned over to the Jews either by you or anybody else." As a Roman citizen, Paul had many rights, and one of the rights was to appeal to the very top of the Roman Empire, to Caesar himself. And that's what Paul does. He appeals to Caesar. And where was Caesar at? Caesar is in Rome, isn't he? Now, Festus, whenever he hears this appeal, Paul says, I appeal to Caesar. When Festus hears that, he confers with his council, probably to see if the appeal has a base, if it's warranted. And the conclusion was, yes, indeed, there is foundation for this appeal. Paul should go to Rome to be tried before Caesar himself. Now, from a human perspective, as we stand back from this whole scenario, who would have thought that God would have fulfilled his promise to Paul in this way? You know, thing after thing happened in Paul's life. And it could have happened out in so many different ways. You know, who would have thought that Paul would have gone to Rome under military escort as he goes to defend himself before Caesar? You know, we would have thought that maybe Paul would have stayed in Caesarea for year after year after year. Maybe he would have died in Caesarea. Maybe he would have been released, and maybe he could have gone to Rome on his own while he was free. Maybe he would have been released to go to Jerusalem, or not released, but gone to Jerusalem, and he would have been killed there. You know, there are any number of what-ifs or scenarios that we could imagine. We think, well, surely the Roman governors will see what's going on here, see that the Jews are trying to frame Paul, and they'll declare him innocent. You know, we think maybe that would have happened, but none of those things happened. Paul is in Caesarea under Felix for 2 years under Roman custody. We have the plot of the Jews again. We have Paul being tried in Caesarea again. And now Festus trying to give the Jews a favor by transferring Paul to Jerusalem. But it's in that whole context that Paul appeals to Caesar. That's how Paul is going to go to Rome. Many people tried to keep Paul from going to Rome. The Jews didn't want Paul to go to Rome. They wanted him to go to Jerusalem, right, so that he could be killed. But in the end, Paul did end up going to Rome. And as we continue reading through Acts, we see Paul in Rome. That's the way God wanted it to be. Now, we today will never probably go to Rome. We might as a tourist, but our scenario is totally different from Paul's scenario. But God still has a plan for us, doesn't he? Now, our lives may seem to be quite ordinary as we have event after event happening in our lives and situation after situation. But God has a plan for us. And many times that plan is going to be fulfilled in a quote-unquote normal way. As things happen in this world, as event after event comes to pass in our lives. But as we stand back and we see how God has fulfilled his plan, many times we will stand in amazement. You know, how has God brought you to the place where you are right now? Can you see God's hand at work? God has a plan and he's fulfilling it. Through all the twists and the turns of life, through the ups and downs, the high peaks and the valleys, God is directing us and he's leading us. This morning, let's rejoice that God is in control. Even in the most quote-unquote random of circumstances, even in the most difficult of times, we know that God is at work to do something good for us ultimately. God has something great and wonderful in store for us, something that's going to bring him great glory. You know, God has saved us, and he has saved us to fulfill his perfect plan and purpose. And so we know that the events of our life ultimately are going to work together for God's great plan, and God is going to be glorified through us. Right along with Paul, we can say this in Romans chapter 8. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom he did predestinate, them he also called. And whom he called, them he also justified. And whom he justified, them he also glorified. See, God has a plan. And Paul right here is really talking about our salvation. And ultimately, we're going to be glorified, aren't we? But all of the things that happened between the time that we trusted in Jesus Christ, and even the time before that, whenever God called us to salvation, you know, and called us and worked so that we were convicted of our sin and trusted in Jesus Christ, all of these things work together for God's glory and for our ultimate good. Because one day we're going to be glorified before Jesus Christ. Paul says in verse 31, "What shall we then say to these things? If God be for us, who can be against us? He that spared not his own Son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things?" God is a God who's all-powerful, who's all-knowing, who's in control. He's a God who works in mysterious ways. And so in our life right now, we may not understand why things are happening the way they are, but be assured, God is at work. This is just a part of his mysterious ways, his plan that we don't know fully how it's going to end up, except for the fact we do know one day we'll be glorified in Jesus' presence. May we live for Jesus without hesitation. No matter how hard the trial, no matter how little we understand what he's doing, let's live for him knowing that he is a God who has a perfect plan and he works in mysterious ways. May our hearts be encouraged this morning.